they always accept your idiosyncrasies, and I think that was true when people went to hear Guthrie Spears. He's somebody you might want to talk to. A minister, Presbyterian minister by Memorial. They used to sit there and hear him every Sunday talk about how everybody was the same. But they didn't believe it at all, but they thought it was just, you know, just Guthrie. And I think a lot of people thought, you know, it was just Jason Kelly, you know. Nobody else would go on this thing. So they are tolerant of you. Either that or they think you're out to destroy their society. You're very dangerous people, and you've got to avoid it.
Can you tell me about some kind of project that McKeldin did after he was out of the office holding positions, when he was just another private citizen?
He was always going into churches and pulpits. And my husband got a little bit of bad habit too, because he used to say he didn't go to church as much except when he was in the pulpit. And I think McKeldin always with the Methodist, even he was always getting up in the pulpit and telling people how they ought to feel about things. I just think that black people loved him, and they should have. Lily Jackson loved my husband. Oh, I can tell you a story about Lily Jackson. Lily Jackson told me that he died. She came up to me in tears, and she said, "The black people are now always the best thing that ever in Great Western." And she had told me in publicly, she had a story when my husband was a very young man, maybe in the juvenile court, I guess he was. She used to tell this story that she had young children. You want her to stop that? And Lily Jackson wanted to have a new life. Her children were grown up, and she was at this meeting, and she heard this young man in a navy blue suit say a very important sentence that just hit her. And he was fresh out of Yale Law School, and that was my husband. And I was Darrell's wife, and he said, "Until the black people in Baltimore and in Maryland do something for themselves, the white people are going to do nothing about it." And she started the NAACP right from that moment on. And they started doing things, and she always said that, sometimes in embarrassing places, because she was putting him, my husband used to say, "Don't do that to me, I have enough problems as it is," with getting money for welfare, where you could put people, hungry people and things. So that it wasn't always the opportune place that she would tell that story, but she told it many times.
That's quite a tribute right there. Great, great inspiration.
Anything good or bad that happens from now on in was all that little man in the blue suit.
You and your husband both said that you were both concerned with general civil rights for everybody and not just for any one group. Although I think there are certain years you can say from 1954 on, when black civil rights was in the forefront and most prominent nationally. But you did work in other areas, especially in social welfare. Did Governor McKeldin also get involved in areas with, say, Jewish people? I know that he appointed some of the first Jewish people to official offices.
My yes. Mental health, that was very unpopular. Everybody that was interested in mental health in those days was supposed to be communist or anybody that didn't like the role of communists. That was just the easiest thing to say about them. They wanted any kind of change, any degree that was uncomfortable and hurt and change.
Do you think that Governor McKeldin's background, coming from a poor family, an immigrant family in an ethnic area, helped to stimulate his interest and to get him to work for people who were poor? Do you think that had a great effect on him?
I did. When we were in Estoril, that's where we were in Portugal, he would never take anything to drink and never do anything, gambler, I think, but they went, my husband persuaded to go into one of these gambling dens. And he went. And he went, we were walking through this very handsome place, and there was a beautiful christening dress of a baby, all handmade, tucked, real lace and things. And they both stopped and looked at that. And it was enormously expensive. And she turned to me, Mrs. McKellen, and she said, you know, when we were first married, we didn't have very much money to put in the bank. And we bought a dress, very much like that, for a young Teddy, their oldest child. Was he the oldest one? Maybe the daughter.
I think the other is.
And we really couldn't afford it. I think that we just decided nothing could be too good. And I think very often, if people haven't had a lot of things like that, they're more apt to spend that kind of money on those kind of things than if they just hadn't. I think that may have. I must have. I know it did as far as the alcoholism in his family was very much concerned with that. He had problems. So I think that does influence people.
What kind of approach did Governor McKeldin have to creating, for example, agencies and offices to help people who needed it? Now, was it easy for your husband to obtain help from McKeldin?
Mm-hmm.
Did he make it easier for your husband to do his job?
That much. And he would, if he felt he had chosen the right person, he gave them a lot of leeway. I mean, we used to go down on that boat and talk about my husband advising Sobolov. Of course, he was his big advisor, George Sobolov. But he would get people like that around him, and then he would pick their brains and ask them for names of people to get. And if he got somebody then into a job, he gave him, he would oversee it, but he would choose the type of person, and he so smart about it, that he would give them leeway to do, you know, if they wanted to do that, and they'd have to have the money. He'd get the money.
Would you consider social welfare and civil rights to be Governor McKeldin's primary interests?
Well, yes, except that health, and it all goes,
I think
it's
it goes
also
together.
Related, children,
that's all part.
Old people, they didn't talk as much about old people in those days. But then that came on.
Well, that's
later.
My next question.
Right.
That's very good timing. I wanted to ask you about the Waxter Center and if Governor McKeldin or Dr. Jackson had anything to do with that.
Yes. Governor McKeldin had a great deal to do with it, and many people have told me I didn't know all the ins and outs of politics of it. But if it hadn't been him two or three times along the way, and other people too, they would have that would have fallen through. He kept them to it, and he was very, be sure to keep that money.
What kind of role did your husband play in the development of the center?
None, because he was, it hadn't been conceived really before he died. And then Dr. Mason Lord was the one that asked me to have it named for him. But he had been the commissioner, the first commissioner, my husband, for the Commission on Aging. And he, with Nathan Schock and these people brought in that to Nathan Schock. The idea that, you know, don't just do for children, you do for old people too. And the whole process of geriatrics and all of that started growing.
That too, it's quite ahead of its time.
That's right.
Just now becoming a major concern.
That's right.
That's
and the wonderful thing is that people, when these things happen, people think they discovered it, you know. The young people think this was their baby. And then they go back and they find it was talked about many years ago, but never happened.
Do you have any sort of favorite stories that you'd like to tell me about Governor McKeldin? He was apparently quite a flamboyant person, really.
Very, very. Let me think. Can you turn that off?
Oh, sure. All right, we could go to Dr. Jackson now. Did you know Dr. Jackson?
She did. Can't go to her. You can go to our daughter.
We've done that. We have long meetings with
her. Go ahead.
Yes, we do.
Did you? I know her well? Yes. Mm-hmm. I did. And she had I went to a meeting once with Mrs. Roosevelt at Juanita's house, Juanita Mitchell's house. And we met Mrs. Roosevelt at the station, and we went up there, and then they had a meeting in the church, that big church there, where they had her service. And she had, we were over there for cookies and coffee or something with Mrs. Roosevelt. And then we went to this church, and the first black policemen were honored that day. And we were all up on the stage, and they were officer, what's his name, Mellon, that was got into so much trouble. He was one of the first policemen. And they were lined up like this, and then they asked me to get up and called my name, and I remember I had to kind of duck down underneath the policeman and sort of come out. The church was filled with people, and it was they were singing, and it was almost an entirely black group of people. It's a bad feeling to be in church with all of one. I've been to commencements of children that I worked with in United Nations Youth, that they'd ask me to their commencement. I'd be the only white person in the place. And it's a very lonely feeling, but it makes you feel that that's the way they must feel all the time. In the old days, not so much now, they get more company.
Did Dr. Jackson's sex at all affect her ability to work in civil rights and her ability to be a leader in the NAACP? Did her
handicap?
No, her sex, being a female, did that have any effect on her position as a leader?
She was sort of an irritant, Juicy. People get furious at her. And in the old days, because she was so fearless, and so she was just like she's scratching a sore, and everybody wanted to leave that sore alone. And her personality was strong and all, but it wasn't. Her facial.
Being a woman have anything to do with it? You know, sometimes mm-hmm. it seems that a good many of the dominant people in the civil rights movement, a lot of the prominent leaders mm-hmm. were women.
Mrs.
Roosevelt, yourself.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if that at all affected her status.
I think that the people that disliked
it helped her or hurt her.
Disliked it so anyway that they didn't care whether they were women or men or children or anybody.
It didn't matter.
I don't think it mattered that too much. That much. I don't really. I don't think we were as conscious of the part that the aggressiveness of women, that what they needed and what they want now. We weren't as conscious of that then.
And yet when Dr. Jackson's daughters applied to colleges, one of the reasons they did not get in was not simply because they were black, but because they were women also.
I'm sure.
Was this also a feeling that she had, that women were part of it too, and that women had to have civil rights, or that just didn't come up at the time?
I think the race problem was so much to the fore then that they didn't really mix the two. And I think the black people maybe now find that difficult in some groups. You know, it's the same idea as my husband saying, I got so many problems. I can't take on anybody else.
In later years, in the 60s, Dr. Jackson didn't die too long ago, and she certainly mm-hmm. was still active. Did this become part of her concern in the later years, the women's movement?
I didn't see enough of it then to know. I guess so.
Was she criticized for the type of actions she took, things like picket lines? Was that a big source of contention? People really didn't like that. Or was it more her pushing for legislation and pushing for court cases? Which bothered people more? Did they just didn't like it at all?
any of them?
Well, I think probably a lot of them said she was, you know, unbalanced. And anything that they was convenient to say, but they didn't work. This kind of thing, I don't think that they, I don't know. It's the kind of excuses of things, of people's conscience, you see. I think people really, their consciences tell them where the what's right and what's wrong, and if somebody keeps after that, they're terrible irritants. And they can't help but want to shut them up.
What kind of influence did Dr. Jackson have on the political leaders, on Governor McKeldin, on your husband? Was she able, did they work with her? Was she respected by them? Or did they also find themselves being pushed by her? I know sometimes Governor McKeldin was known to say that, he, in one paper article I read, that he would rather have the devil on his tail than Willie Mae Jackson.
That's right. I think that they wanted to work with her, you know, and, but mostly to keep her quiet, not to give her what she wanted. I think, you know, to make them not to really.
This wasn't your husband, though, and Governor
what?
McKeldin. This was other leaders.
Oh.
This was not, your husband did not, and Governor McKeldin did not resist.
No, I don't think so. I think that they felt that that she was getting a lot of everybody else's fire, you know, that she was willing to be that one out front like that. And then she really was so. But she didn't have those kind of ingratiating gifts, you see. She did when you knew her as a person and all, and respected her. But she just would come in and say something that a lot of people would say, oh, you know, if she would just stay quiet, you know, it'd be all right. I remember once in the junior league, that's what happened to me. They sent somebody to get me, and they sent the bishop's wife and someone else so that I wouldn't get up. It was when they wanted to know whether a group of school teachers could use the junior league office, and that meant using the bathroom, of course, have a meeting there. And there was a big to-do about it, and people complained, and they had this meeting, and they sent it like to Gestapo's to me, to the bishop's wife and somebody else. And the president told me afterwards that they had been told if I got up to say anything, ask a question, just stood on my feet, the whole thing would have been ruined. And they had a meeting, and the younger people sat at one end of that, where the Park Plaza is, and the older people in the other. And they had a little racial battle right there. And I didn't get up, and they made it mine if I had gotten up, all hell would have broken loose or something. These two people, the children that had been to college, and the people that didn't want to associate with black people socially, business way or any other. And they finally persuaded them. It was all right. And that was real progress because they did. But there is a time when you should speak out, and then there is a time when you should stay quiet and let other people do it. Sometimes that's very hard for people that are impatient. I'm sure that was hard for Lily Paxton. I'm not sure she ever accomplished. Didn't speak yet.
Always speaking up. Dr. Jackson was quite well educated and certainly did not experience the economic hardships that much of the black community did as an adult. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even as a child, she was certainly not by those standards poor. Mm-hmm. Did that difference have any effect, any cooling effect, or did it tend to separate her from the black community? Was she still able to relate? Because the problems that she was having were different than the ones the vast majority of the community had.
That's right. I don't believe so. I wouldn't think so.
She was very close to them.
That's right. And then, of course, they weren't, today you hear about the concerned about their husband. But there weren't as many people like that. And nobody really brought that up. Maybe they weren't as competitive, you see, now that people are so competitive. In that day, they weren't that competitive. There weren't the opportunities.
Dr. Jackson worked primarily in the Baltimore area, did she?
Mm-hmm.
Did she ever feel, or did anyone ever feel, that she should take her talents and take her ability to effect change and use it on a national level or even a broader level than just Baltimore?
Baltimore. I don't believe so.
She was content to stay mm-hmm. working with her own community.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of specific goals were achieved by Dr. Jackson.
A lot of what?
Specific goals, opening of the Maryland Law School, and a lot of individual court cases were won.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, though, that black and white relationships were really improved, say, well, anywhere along the line, from the 40s right on through the 70s,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps I think we could stop, say, right before the riots, the middle mm-hmm. 60s, when Johnson passed mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act.
Were they improved?
Do you really think, in Baltimore, do you really think that there was an improvement in the way black and white people felt about each other?
There were a lot of cocktail parties and things that people were invited to, you know, because they were black, because they wanted to work with people. But that is a sort of a superficial thing. I think that except among the younger group, I think they have a different attitude about this than the older people. And I think that goes for the Jewish group. You know, I mean, Jewish people found it difficult to do business downtown, and then they go home and live over there all together like that. And you know, it's a dreadful city, this one. The way the lines are drawn, so much of it has to do with ancestry, don't you?
Well, sometimes it's good for a group to live together. It helps preserve certain things.
It makes them stronger.
Sometimes it really helps. But it doesn't help if they're living together in poverty and in a depressed area.
And in an inferior. This is the problem between the Jewish people and the black people. And many Jewish people say, well, we have had a hard time, and we made it, and we've educated our children, and we've disciplined our children. We have talents and things that we've contributed to our community. So therefore, there is more resentment between these two groups at the moment. Don't you think so?
Yeah, there definitely is. It's a lot has to do with the fact that the Jewish businesses are still in the black areas.
That's
and the
right.
black people, now they can shop where they can work, but they can't own the shops.
That's
for
right.
the next step. If there was any degree of improvement in the way black and white people felt about each other here, how much was due directly to the work that Dr. Jackson was doing in the NAACP? How much was that kind of thing, or how much was just the fact that people had to learn to live together eventually?
Mm.
How much credit can Dr. Jackson be given?
Well, that's a hard question, isn't it? How do we know if she hadn't been doing anything, you wouldn't have known. It's like saying, you know, take vitamins and you will get colds, but how do you know if you didn't take them, you know? But I wouldn't say that. No.
Well,
I think it was the combination of many people. She wouldn't have known it, but lots of people.
Well, sometimes you might find an area that black people have moved into and the white people have stayed,
mm-hmm.
and they've learned to live together and go to school together because
mm-hmm.
they've had to.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it just happens by itself, but other people would feel that that could never have happened in the first place if it weren't for people like Dr. Jackson.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's true.
Did Dr. Jackson and Governor McKeldin personally have any friendship, or were they basically just people who worked together on a professional level?
I wouldn't know. I would think that they, it would be more professional in those days particularly.
Do you think that, well, there were riots in many, many cities here. Do you think that someone like Dr. Jackson could have had an effect of stopping, in Baltimore they happened later than in other cities. Do you think that people like Dr. Jackson and the work that she did helped to prevent them a little bit, or helped to make them, make people wait a while before they finally got that frustrated?
For the riot, you mean?
Right. Because people here waited. They didn't start rioting as quickly as in other
mm-hmm.
cities.
Mm-hmm.
People like
she
Dr.
was
Dr.
very upset. I remember once talking to me about these young black people and how upset she was with what they were doing, how they were going to ruin, you know, all the slow, hard work that she had been doing. She was rather intolerant of that at one point.
I can see where she
I think she did.
Did she ever try to get to the leaders in the 1960s who were the militant leaders and try and talk to them, try and stop them?
Probably. I don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised. And they would have probably said, well, you know, you believe in these white people and these things, but we don't. And we think they're just fake, you know, they're not going to stand by us when we really need them.
Did Dr. Jackson herself, from what you know from talking to her, did she feel that she had accomplished some really permanent, lasting harmony or degree of harmony between black and white people? Did she feel that she had been successful? Was she happy with her work and
mm-hmm.
pleased with what she had done?
I talked to her on the phone in her day, but I didn't really see as much of other women, Juanita or her at that point, and she didn't go, you know, to the meetings and things. So that I think she was a product of her time more. And I don't think she really understood what the young blacks were saying or doing. I think she really wouldn't sort of go on with them, you see, as much as I could.
She was also concerned, too, with not just black civil rights, but everybody's civil
That's
rights.
Right.
So that for her, probably, this is a whole new outlook.
That's right.
To be concerned only with one group
mm-hmm.
at a time.
Although she was always only concerned with one group. I mean, if she ever got up to speak, she spoke for the black people. One single voice for a very, very long time. So, and maybe it was hard for her to recognize other voices. You know, when you've been alone for so long. It's hard to see the different angles that other people might get.
Did she finally leave the active movement because of age, or was it because of the times changing? What influence was there that made her stop her work?
I'm not sure, but I imagine it's a combination of that. And her techniques, you see, I think techniques change. So her technique of what some people might call rabble rousing, you know, getting the people all excited and ready and able to move and all that was not the technique of the younger black people. So I think they might have felt about her the same way that the white people felt, you know, why doesn't she keep quiet, she's going to do more harm than good. That's all. I don't know that, I just get it.
You're talking
in
about
the 60s, we had a meeting here of people that came to just together because I had a friend that we were talking about what Baltimore needed. And one of the things we thought they needed was to know each other. So we had people come and bring food, and they came for supper and ate together and had a little something to drink, and then they came for brunch sometime on Sunday, and the last one was at night for supper. And they came from all over, and the idea that we got was that people from the artistic world didn't always meet the do-gooders and the welfare people, and that these two groups are really very much alike, and they have gifts and things that they should exchange and know what one was doing with them. So we got all these people. We had Catholic nuns, and we had black activists, and we had black conservatives, and we had white conservatives, and we had artists and novelists, and I don't know, all of these different people here together. And they sat around this room, and they talked or told who they were or where they came from. But the important thing that happened was that they got to know each other, and so many good people.